9 out of 10, 2040 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome once again to the quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. And this episode is all a question of access. I'm in a new house. It's been a while, a long time, too long since we have had an episode. And it's been a while since I've even been able to find the things we use to podcast with microphones and software and all that sort of stuff in the midst of a move. So it makes sense to talk about how we access films these days, again, with Brian, as one of his favorite ways to watch movies. Looks like it is subject to a big, big change. We'll also then be doing Brian's top five movies that you can catch on streaming services if you have access to those. But as always, we begin our journey thanking you for listening, downloading, maybe even sharing this with a friend. And we all wait to hear from Brian. What movie are you on?
Earlier today, I logged the 9,913.
Feels like we are going to coast in to 10,000.
I think if I average one movie every third day, I'll be okay. Unless I just completely blow through and don't see anything for a while. It's not really a question of if, it's a question of when I want to and which movie. That's kind of planning things.
Yeah, it's a question of how you want to savor the last bites of this very large meal, and maybe even what goals you want to set for the stretch run and even after that. But it's very, very exciting and gives us a lot of things to think about. First, though, tell us, what was that 9,913th film that you saw?
The movie I watched today was from an early 90s movie with Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn, House Sitter.
I remember that movie.
Directed by Frank Oz, and it was okay. Yeah, but one of the things I've been doing is as I get closer, I'm taking some time to rewatch some films that I know I've seen, but I couldn't really tell you when I saw them. So I want to make sure they're all sort of fresher in my memory.
Now that's interesting. One of our first topics on the quest for 10,000 was talking about rewatching things, and that was something you definitely said you were not doing very much on this quest.
I have been there. What I did was I went through. I have a service or a website I use and I blog, and the ones that I just couldn't think of or didn't have a time that I knew I had seen it, I'm saying, okay, I'm going to make this legit, and I'm going to document and say I watched it on this day. So I'm rewatching a lot of it, more so than I have at any other time. And one of the movies that I had not seen in a long time, and it was a movie from a little earlier than that, with Steve Martin, Parenthood, and which became the inspired the TV show on NBC or whatever it was. It was in a double feature DVD with House Sitter, so I figured I had the DVD, I might as well watch it.
Well, there you go, and you needed to do that.
It was not even on my radar. Not something. I mean, unless I was just trying for whatever reason to be a Steve Martin, you know, completist, which I wasn't. But
well, you can't get complacent on this quest at all. Steve Martin still seems relevant today. Goldie Hawn is someone who really hasn't been in very many films lately, has she?
No. And if you watched her most recent effort, and I used the word effort generously.
Right, that was in the Amy Schumer movie?
Yes, and it was abysmal. I mean, I watched it, and it was horrible. And some of that is because I think and you find this happening with a lot of comedians, especially comedians who aren't always staying in the game. Their timing and their kind of the subtleties of their humor sort of gets fixed in the time and doesn't adapt. And so all of a sudden, I think maybe some of the game had passed her by because she had not been using those skills. And it was just not good.
Well, let's talk, though, about our big topic for this episode. It's one you brought forward, Brian. Because a lot of your quest has been able to be completed because of this particular service. So tell us about what's going on with FilmStruck.
Well, about 2 years ago, TCM, Turner Classic Movies, part of Warner Home Video, Warner Properties, partnered with the Criterion Collection to create a home for the, both of their sort of catalog of films that they had available for streaming, and they would curate them and put new films out every week, and they would also do something that somebody like Netflix or Hulu doesn't do, is they would make little special features for each sort of film with some sort of commentary and explaining things about why this film's important in that film. And it's been going on for 2 years, and last week, at the end of the week, AT&T, which has now acquired Warner, just shuttered it because apparently one of the mandates they had when they took over the Warner properties was we're going to stop the bleeding, per se, and things that we don't find to be profitable, we're going to cut them off because apparently Warner had been under poor management for some time, and it was, AT&T was just not going to have it. And Filmstruck is one of the things that, that you know, they called it a niche service, which, to be fair, it probably is. And that's another issue I want to talk about is why do we think, or why is it that, because you go on Netflix now, and you're not going to find very many movies before 1985 or so. Like, it's just a dearth of movies. Some will, like, jump out, and obviously, you know, the heavy hitters. But overall, their library skews not just majorly, but almost entirely towards movies that are less than a decade old. And it's not because there isn't quality stuff out there, it's just because it gets overwhelmed by the sheer number. Nobody wants to watch an old movie or something like that.
Right. Well, first, let's talk about in the short term and in the long term. What does this mean kind of for you personally in terms of watching movies, do you think? And then what does it maybe mean long term? And that might get us more into those questions of you know, just access to movies and, uh-huh. and maybe how the audience today has transformed kind of what is kind of produced and marketed and shown to us, making classic movies maybe a little bit more niche, as you say. So first, the short-term things. What do you think this means in the short term?
Well, I mean, I won't find as many foreign films, and one of the things that I'm working my way through is the Criterion Collection itself. They've released now about 1,100 movies under their brand, and I've watched roughly 800 of them. So to get those final 300 may be a little more challenging in the short term. I'm not really so worried. I'm worried so much about the Criterion people, though their brand is significant enough. I think they'll find a home, whether it be going back to Hulu, who was their partner years ago, or maybe even becoming a Netflix sort of. I think they'll shy away from Netflix, but I don't know. Or striking out their own. What's going to be more difficult, though, are these movies that came out in the high age, golden age of Hollywood that are just going to be really, really obscure titles that you just, you know, like a minor title in Henry Ford's or Henry Fonda's, you know, catalog or Humphrey Bogart. You're just not going to find. I'm just not going to be able to find them. They don't get released on DVD. Sometimes there's copyright issues. It's just going to be hard to find.
So, instinctively, I feel like that's a loss. In some ways. But explain, though, more. I can't articulate much of that beyond instinct. It's bad to lose one's history.
It's ironic because we simultaneously have more of our history documented than ever before, but we are at the same time kind of just forgetting and losing so much of the past 60, 70 years, just throwing it away, and it's becoming more and more like a specialized sort of subset of people that only they know or have seen or have experienced these works of art. I'll give you an example, and this is one of the problems I think that is at the root of this, is I think the complexities of copyright law and who's benefiting and who's making the money off of some of these films. There was a filmed version of the George Gershwin opera, Porgy and Bess, and Sidney Poitier is the Porgy in Porgy and Bess. And, it's a much-loved opera, and Sidney Poitier is a much-loved actor, and you would think that this would have some sort of, like, historical values, directed by famous guy Otto Preminger. I think Sammy Davis Jr. has a small part in the movie. But it's almost impossible to get a hold of because of copyright complexities. Like, there's different estates that are involved, and the Gershwins don't want people to see it. And so it's very, very difficult to watch. And there's a lot of times like that where what happens is, for things that haven't lapsed, the copyright has not lapsed, major media companies just keep putting the copyright on again in the hopes that one day this property will be valuable, either as being something they can sell as a remake or something they can use to mine for some other way. But they're not really interested in letting people see it. They just want to hold on to the intellectual property of it.
I mean, it makes sense. You know, they're in it to make money. They are a business. Film is a business. But obviously, that compromises the art of it as well.
Well, and our copyright law, and it's soapbox in mind for a little while, even before I started watching hot movies. Okay, in the 90s, the copyright law was set in a way where, and it's always been set, where once the author or the originator of the work dies, the copyright will be in effect for a set number of years after their death. Well, in the 90s, the Walt Disney Company was bumping up against some deadlines where all of a sudden a lot of the old Mickey Mouse cartoons were about to become public domain. And the same thing was true for the Gershwin estate. And they lobbied Congress and they said, well, let's extend it by 15 years. And now every time they bump up against it, they're like, oh, we need to push it. Well, there is no reason why George Gershwin's grandchildren should be profiting from music that is 100 years old. It makes no sense.
Is that why we have the FBI warnings in front
exactly.
of old VHS?
Somewhat, because there's all these, like, they want to protect their cash cows or their things, so they push it off. And so you wind up with things that should be. I mean, that I don't want to take something away from somebody that's trying to make a living. That's not what I want to do. But what I want to say is that when that person has been dead for 50 years, I feel fairly comfortable in saying that I shouldn't necessarily have to pay to see this.
You mentioned that it's ironic that, you know, we can document our history more and more effectively in a much more egalitarian way. Anybody with a cell phone camera can do that, post it on YouTube, do those sorts of things, and yet we're also losing our history. And it just, you know, we've talked before on this podcast about independent film and how that's made film more of a common experience. You know, you can see movies, it's made people more participatory in a way, and so it's really kind of broken down a lot of barriers maybe to getting into making movies, filmmaking, doing that sort of thing. Because of these streaming services, you can get access to a lot of films that you may not have, you just didn't have. You know, even though now you're going to have to hunt for some of these foreign movies a little bit more. I mean, on the net, you still have way more than you did years ago.
Certainly.
And now you're starting to see these streaming services get into some of their own productions and that kind of thing. So they found it's also cheaper to do that than pay for the rights, copyright, whatever, to do this. So it's also, to me, it's just another irony that even though there's way more ways to watch films, there still are these complexities about who does have access and what you can see. I'm always intrigued by you know, what comes on Netflix each month, what goes off Netflix, when it comes on, when it comes back, a film that's been off for a while, when it comes back. You know, in recent news, too, just in the last couple of weeks, the first two Marvel Netflix series got canceled. Iron Fist 2, which didn't really surprise many folks.
And then Luke Cage.
Luke Cage, which really surprised people. And the kind of the hidden message to me in that is that, well, Disney is starting their own streaming service. And they don't want to go into production with these things, or they want to kind of they want to go ahead and make a clean break for this intellectual property. They can show it on their own streaming service. At least Luke Cage, I think that's possible for.
Well, and to the extent they want to keep the characters, and even if they're not interested in Iron Fist Season 3, they're interested in maybe the Iron Fist character being a part of the Luke Cage universe or something like
And it's purely an economic, you know, type of deal. It's entirely economic. I mean, all the Disney movies that are on Netflix are all going to go away. Star Wars, Marvel movies, you know, everything's going to go away. But at the same time, there may be some stuff, you know, some Disney classic stuff that hasn't been on a lot of these streaming services that suddenly will be available once Disney does that. So there is a lot of give and take with that.
And what it makes you aware, and of course, you know, this is not a new phenomenon, but it makes you more aware of it in a modern way to the input and the influence that money has in what art gets made and what art survives. You know, you always have people that artists, like the theory or the romanticized myth of the starving artist, you know, like Van Gogh and these kind of things that never really saw the fruits of their labor in their lifetime. And those are very powerful sort of myth. But the reality is most artists that we remember probably sold their paintings or had a patron or had some sort of revenue stream. And the same thing is true for movies as well. We will have some occasional movies that break through, but the most of them, if you're not a part of this system and this ecosystem of who Netflix money and which is why you're seeing so many people, even, you know, respected people, flocking to Netflix because the money is there. You know, you have Alfonso Cuarón is making a Netflix movie that may be an awards contender, Roma, this next season. The Coen brothers have one coming out in November of this year. Martin Scorsese has one coming out next year. So there's a lot of money at stake. And I think some of these people that have been struggling for a long time with securing the funds through the studio system are, you know, flocking to the, because it's just, Netflix is just throwing money at the wall to see what sticks.
And I want to say one more thing before we get into our top five. The other piece that this brings home for me, and what's still maybe kind of yet to be determined, I think it was, it wasn't Neil Postman, but Neil Postman quoted the person who said this, the medium is the message. The medium is the massage. You know, how we view the media, the format in which we view it, also shapes the message, shapes that sort of thing. And this gets back into, I think, what you were talking about the way that even as we produce, we may lose some of our history. You know, some of those classic movies perhaps don't work as well for some of these streaming platforms, some of the binge nature that we have, as well as just some of the particular aesthetic that we have for films nowadays. I mean, you look even thematically at some films, you know, something like Rocky, which I think both you and I love, doesn't make as much sense today, particularly perhaps in the way it ends. Another podcast I heard talking about this a couple of years ago.
Rocky compared to Creed or compared to Balboa, you know, you watch those two movies, and it's almost like you would have to be convinced it was a sequel to this first movie.
Right.
Like it feels so different. It's like night and day.
Right. And just, you know, in terms of the way things end and you know, the abruptness of the ending of Rocky, which again to us is a classic, but for other people now, that just seems like a really weird place to end the film. So I think that's something that'll be unfolding as well with this as maybe movies get more and more produced for our computer screens as much as anything. How will that continue to shape what film is going to be and what's going to be remembered and what may not be remembered? So still a lot of questions to be answered. I think, obviously, I know personally you're just sad about that loss of something that's been able to get you so close on your quest.
I'm going to spend the next month burning through as much of their catalog as I can. It's going to be I'm going to prioritize it in a way I might not have otherwise because I want to try to get through as much of it before it disappears.
Well, our top five this episode is going to be based on that particular streaming catalog. So Brian said it already, the Criterion Collection that was on FilmStruck. So we're going to hear from Brian what his top five Criterion Collection films are, many of which he saw on this streaming service. So Brian, kind of give us maybe a little bit of an introduction into this top five. Given that it's 1,100 movies, that might be a little bit hard to narrow the focus on.
Yeah, I'm not. This is not necessarily the top. This is five that I would highly recommend that they have put out. And like they're putting out additionally, you know, 20 to 30 films a year. And when they put a movie out, especially on DVD, they remaster it. They do a direct. They were sort of the pioneers of the director commentary, and so they give you the bells and whistles so that you know why this movie, you know, should be included, is included, and why it gets their stamp of approval. But these are five that, and some of these are some of my favorite films of all time. So these are five that I would recommend.
So these would be in sort of descending order. Like if you have this set of time, you know, you would say, go see this, really go see this, very much go see this, definitely go see this.
Yeah,
why are you not watching this right now?
Like, this is to me, the last one is to me an essential. Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, what's your number five? If you have time, you should really try to see this.
Number five is a movie by Wim Wenders, Paris, Texas. It's got Dean Stockwell. It's a starring role, a rare starring role for Harry Dean Stanton, who is sort of the prototypical
Molly Ringwald's dad.
Yeah, he's in a lot of stuff, and I think Roger Ebert had a rule that he said any movie that featured Harry Dean Stanton or M. Emmett Walsh cannot be all bad.
Didn't he give Mark Ruffalo his pants in Avengers?
I think so. I think he was in the event.
That's right.
That's accurate.
Yeah. What is Paris, Texas about, real quick?
It's an amnesiac named Travis Harrison Stanton who he's attempting to reunite with his brother and his 7-year-old son in the titular Paris, Texas.
All right.
He's sort of been out of their life for a while. Now he's come back and he's sort of. It's just lovely. It's a good. You know, it's well worth checking out. Number four is a movie from the. Late 40s, with starring Alec Guinness, called Kind Hearts and Coronets. He plays like 20, well not 20, but he plays like 10 different parts in the movie, including, he plays 9 members of this royal family. And, the gist of it is, as his most recent incarnation, he's trying to kill everyone else off so he can inherit the money. It's really good.
So here's a great example of what you were talking about, too. For most people, I think, our age, other than maybe Bridge on the River Kwai, they don't know that Alec Guinness has been in stuff other than Star Wars.
Yeah, I mean, you hear Alec Guinness, it's Obi-Wan, that's it. And he was, I mean, he did have a lengthy career, not just in that, but he had several movies, some really dark comedies. He was in Lawrence of Arabia. He was in a lot of stuff with David Lean. He was in...
he was the Pope in Brother, Son, Sister Moon.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. And most of us, you know, you have Obi-Wan and you sort of like... And sadly, that's true for a lot of people. They get one role and it's like that's all they ever did. Well, not really.
But it really is. It really is a phenomenon there where we forget the history because of just kind of that seminal moment. And it's almost like nothing else was before that. Everything after... Star Wars, so that's interesting. So need to check that one out with Sir Alec.
That was funny. It's darkly funny, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it recently inspired a musical that was on Broadway recently. Yeah, and it won the Tony for Best Musical, Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, and that was from 2013. So it's inspired by the same source material.
All right, number three.
This is a movie, again, a little older. This is a movie with Kirk Douglas, and everybody or most people are aware of Kirk's later collaboration with Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus. But this one came first, and it's called Paths of Glory. It is about World War One and trench warfare, and Kirk plays a soldier who, I guess he's not a soldier. He's a higher up in the military chain of command who like refuses an order, and then his men are going to be executed because of cowardice. And but it's really, really good. And we don't have a lot enough. I don't think World War One movies. We have plenty of World War Two movies. We don't have enough about you know, what the First World War was about, and about trench warfare, and about how really brutal that was. And this is a great, a lot of the movie feels claustrophobic because they're like running in between these trenches and the walls, or, you know, they're just hallways, and that's where they're living, and it's so cool.
There are people who are fans of Legends of the Fall that will disagree about the number of World War One movies we have, but that's a conversation for another day. What is the second movie that, if you have time right now, why are you not watching this?
The second one is, again, it's an older, a little older movie, but it's an adaptation of Beauty and the Beast by a filmmaker-poet called Jean Cocteau, and it's from 1946. And you watch this movie and you see that Disney stole his design for the Beast almost verbatim when they did the musical that we all love. I mean, that he did it 50 years before them. But it's just such a wonderful film version of a fairy tale. And fairy tales are hard to film because you can't, especially with practical effects, because you don't want it to be hokey looking, but you also don't want it to be just ordinary, normal looking. So you got to find that balance. And it's, you know, it's a story we all love, but it's one of my favorite versions of the story.
All right. So number one, the movie that you need to be watching right now. Oh my God, why are you not watching this right now? From the Criterion Collection.
Well, it's one of my favorite movies. One of my favorite movies.
Please don't say Cloud Atlas. Please don't say Cloud Atlas.
Cloud Atlas has not had yet a Criterion Collection release. This is an Ingmar Bergman film from the late 50s. It's called The English title is Wild Strawberries. It's about a guy who is an old man who's sort of recalling his past as he goes. He's a professor, and he's on his way to give a lecture. And he's sort of on his way. He sees things that make him think about the things that he's done and have happened in his life, and he sort of ruminates on that. And being a Bergman film, it's very existential in that way. But, you know, I love it. It was my first Bergman film. It was the best introduction I could have had. And some of his other stuff gets a little too pretentious for me, but this is, I think, one of the best films he made.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for that top five, Brian. Kind of a walk down some of these classic movies, and folks should go see them to remember our history. I know I'll be trying to see what I can find of these before Filmstruck goes away for good. Hopefully, friends, we will not go away for good, or at least not as long as we were last time. We hope to come back very soon with another episode where we continue to go with Brian as he hits this home stretch of his quest for 10,000 movies before he turns 40. Thank you for joining us this episode. Thank you for joining us for other episodes, and we hope that you will stay with us in the future as well. Check us out on Twitter at 10K, T-E-N-K Movies, or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. Until next time, we hope that your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline 11.